Well, Mom, I'm gonna have to disappoint you. No Das Torah coming from me. Maybe at the end I'll tell you what Avraham Ravitzky said about Das Torah. Okay, it's 9 o'clock, everyone. Today is March 16th, and okay, we have obviously with all the craziness out there, we can hopefully spend an hour, take our mind off it, a little more than an hour, perhaps. I turned off. I'm in a different room, which is also has to do with the crazy situation we're in, and I thought maybe that light that you see there was annoying people, so I turned it off. Let's just pick up where we left off. There's only two more classes scheduled to deal with the Mitziv, and I still have a lot I want to get to. Hopefully today even we'll get to the story of the closing of the Vilozhin Yeshiva, but there's a few other things I want to get to. Just picking up from last time though, I think I forgot to mention something. We learned the important tshuva of the Mitziv. I mean, we read discussed it about Al Yamin and Smol and left and right and right and left, and really his response to extremism, and he wants to walk the middle path. And I told you that you can find a translation of it in Howard Joseph's article as swords thrust through the body, the Mitziv's rejection of separatism. I never explained, I don't think, where that word comes from, as swords thrust through the body. In the tshuva himself itself, he in his criticism of the Machzikei Hadas for encouraging separatism, the sort of separatism we know from Germany and from Hungary, that's what the Nitziv says, that this separatism, separating from the non-religious and less religious when it comes in all matters, when it comes in particular, we're talking about dealing with the non-Jewish authorities. Obviously, we fight internally, but not externally. He says that is as harsh as swords thrust through the body and the survival of the nation. And as I mentioned, this whole attitude, this opposition to separatism, was followed very much from by Rav Kook, by Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rav Kook goes so far as to say that, and he's famous for this, that the ideas of separatism, those the advocacy of separatism, is a Maisa Amalek. It's what the Amalekites did. They wanted to break the Jewish people. So that's where that comes from. The other thing I wanted to mention before we pick up is that I forgot to say one other thing. We went through all about the Vilozhin Yeshiva and the significance of it. I forgot to mention that in this book, which I've quoted a few times, Yeshiva Brita, Pirkei Zichronot, and you can see it's a thick book edited by Emanuel Etkes, mean the famous Emanuel Etkes, scholar of Lithuanian yeshivot, and not just that, he wrote a book on Rav Shneur Zalman of Vladi. But most of his work has dealt with Lithuanian non-Hasidic phenomena. And also Shlomo Tykoshinsky edited this. Shlomo Tykoshinsky published a wonderful book on the Chevron slash Slobodka Yeshiva. But if you look in this book on page 108, and this is what I forgot to mention, is that in discussing the yeshiva, and this is the memoir of Moshe Elazar Eisenstadt. Remember the Eisenstadt, that his mother was an Eisenstadt. We spoke about this, takes us back to very early, the very first class. We spoke about the Panim Meiros, who you can go see his grave right now in the city of Eisenstadt. And but he says as follows, that davening, he says, I would get up at 9 a.m. and go to yeshiva for shacharis. I don't think it means 9 a.m. the way we think of 9 a.m. I don't know what he means by nine, but it's not 9 a.m. the way we think of 9 a.m. I'm assuming that seems to be too late, obviously during the week. And then he says, but davening took between 15 and 20 minutes. And he says, from the first day I was there, I paid attention to the fact that in our yeshiva they didn't treat davening very significantly, because b'merkaz amud limud ha-talmud, in the center of everything was Gemara learning. Anyone who knows about the Lithuanian yeshiva world knows that davening was not taken that seriously. It's a little strange to say this today, when everyone speaks about how we have to focus more on our davening, and we have. I mean, the Chaim Soloveitchik was known to have davened very quickly, and I think they say, what is it? The Rambam who says that, or who says that? It's like you're counting money, and he says, I count my money quickly. We know Tefillah B'Tzibur was not taken that seriously in the Lithuanian yeshiva world. We know that they would stay up late, many of the Bachrim, and they'd wake up whatever time. Again, it's hard to imagine 9 a.m., but that they would miss it. Tefillah B'Tzibur for Mincha. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg mentions how he would daven b'yichidus. I have other examples of gedolim who would daven b'yichidus, because if you're sitting here in the middle of learning a sugya, you're in the middle of a hard Tosfos, and you look at the clock, and the clock says 2 p.m., and you're about to start davening mincha in 5 minutes down the hall. You have a choice: do you leave it or do you go? And we know that for many, they felt that tefillah b'tzibur was not the be-all and end-all, and they did not leave. And here we see that 15-20 minutes. Look, I don't even know how you do it in 15-20 minutes. I get it, half hour, but so maybe there's a bit of an exaggeration. But this is just repeating what we know from lots of other sources, that the stress was not on davening. Maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's why you had so many problems in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, that people left because they didn't focus. It was all intellectual. Rav Shach famously said the reason why he wasn't zochet to have, so it's recorded, this religious grandchildren like so many others, is because they didn't sing Zmiros at his table. And it was too much of the head, not enough of the heart. But that's the Lithuanian yeshiva world. We saw already 2 weeks ago how the Netziv, even when his wife was ill, he didn't want to stop the learning to recite Tehillim. So I just wanted to call that to your attention about the lack of significance given to your. And I've said in the past, Shaul Lieberman, those who. Interesting about Shaul Lieberman. I posted, if you read the Sforim blog, I posted that amazing letter, and I forgot to thank the person who alerted me to it. I mean, I knew this. I went through the archive, but I went to the archive in like 2005 and or 2004, and I only made copies. In those days, it was quite expensive to make copies. And like today, you can make copies with your camera. So I didn't make a copy of this. And a couple of years ago, 3 years ago actually, someone who also was going through the archive, he sent me a number of things, and I had, though most of them I already had. In fact, some of the things he sent me, I included in Shaul Lieberman and the Orthodox. But he also sent me, and I'm going to be correcting this in my next post, give him credit. He sent me the letter I put on, which I had did not have a copy of, even though I had seen it. And when I went to my files to find something interesting to put in about Saul Lieberman, and I saw that there, and I have the copy of the page, the permission given to me from the seminary to post it. And I'm the only one who has permission to post it. I had forgotten that he had actually alerted me to it. In any event, it's the letter of Saul Lieberman to about the about Rav Chaim Kanievsky, and 50 years ago, saying that he should be awarded this prize they're giving, this monetary prize for great Torah scholars. Well, the day after my post went up, I get an email from a friend of mine in Lakewood. He sends me a copy of the picture and says that I should see this. It's like it's a big deal. And he didn't even know that I'm the one who posted it. So what that shows you is that it's the letter is already going all over the yeshiva world now. And I even saw that people were citing it, because Rav Chaim Kanievsky's role in the situation in Israel, should they stop learning or keep learning? So why is that relevant to Shaul Lieberman? Because I quoted Hillel Halkin's memoir. I've done this a few times, where Shaul Lieberman, who, if anyone is representative of coming out of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, it's him, in which he said to Hillel Halkin, why do I have to daven? God knows everything I need, and it's Bittul Torah. So it's a sense even of not having this connection to davening. Which again, maybe is a problem in the Lithuanian world, that it's too much of the head, not enough of the heart. Maybe it's no accident that the YU now has, I think it's two Hasidic mashgichim, Rabbi Weinberger and Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Weinberger. If anyone would have told, us 20 years ago that YU, which is, sort of like Volozhin in America, the rough thought, that they'd have a non-Litvish mashgiach, people would think you're crazy. But getting back to Hillel Halkin, so Hillel Halkin says, even though Shaul Lieberman expressed this sort of, that I don't need to daven, God knows what I need, and it's Bittul Torah. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, he'd be under his tallis over his head, and he'd be crying. So even Shaul Lieberman, the uber intellectual, at times he still showed, that the importance of tefillah. Okay, I'll get to all the comments, towards the end. I want to pick up just quickly because we have a lot to do where we left off. We are dealing with Nitziv's essay on anti-Semitism. And I ended by mentioning something which is very traditional, although it makes people today uncomfortable, the idea that, when there's problems in the world for the Jews, it's we, look for the Jews, basically blaming the victim, that the Jews have sinned, we've sinned, and therefore God is punishing us. This is actually a very traditional approach. It became perhaps problematic with the Holocaust because to say that, a million children and all the other tzaddikim were killed because of sins, although this was the reason, if you look at the Sfarim in the years after the Holocaust, that's the reason they give. The Lubavitch Rebbe famously comes out against this and says that we cannot use this explanation. But that's, it's a classic reason given for why people suffer, even if you can't understand it. It's because of sins. That doesn't mean that they, I mean, you can look at even the Chmelnytskyi pogroms. You have all sorts of strange reasons given, talking during davening, all stuff that today would be unimaginable because we have a very different, in general, we approach these things very differently. Everyone never can understand how Rav Vadi Yosef could come up with all these reasons for the terrible things happening, and they were offended. And but it's a different approach, and we have to put ourselves sometimes in a very different mindset. A more traditional mindset where people are taught to look for those sorts of things, even though, as I said, the book of Job, Eov specifically says, and this is the Eov's friend's mistake, that you can't identify reasons for these things. And Rav Soloveitchik quotes that as explaining why he does not believe in the whole venture of theodicy. Theodicy is to try to justify God in the face of evil. He's opposed to that, and he cites Eov. But the Nitziv has a different approach, and I'll just give you a couple other examples of this from this interesting essay of his, which also Howard Joseph translated it. You can see the title page here, Why Anti-Semitism, a translation of his essay, The Remnant of Israel, which you can find the original Hebrew as part of his commentary on Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs. He says, on page 34 and 35 in the book, he quotes the Nitziv as saying how there are non-Jews who like the Jews and have our best interests at heart. His whole idea is that, but if we do not live up to what it means to be a Jew, then they will turn against us. And he says, in the Middle Ages, many left our faith, leaving no remnant. And then he talks about, the Muranos, etc. But when did the difficulties happen? Because they came in when that is when the Jews came into actual direct contact with the non-Jews. Israel was not careful about preserving its separateness through its religious faith and practical commandments. Israel became lowly in their eyes because they had no divine faith. So he develops this idea that the non-Jews respect Jews, not all of them, but that your non-Jews will respect Jews, many of them. When Jews are observant and Jews are committed to Torah and mitzvot, when Jews want to act like non-Jews, they want to join their country clubs, they want to join their societies, and are not separate, that leads to a rise of anti-Semitism precisely because the non-Jews can deal with the Jews when the Jews are in their own sphere. What they don't want is the Jews to enter their sphere. Change their names from Moses into I don't know, you know those the whole in America we have the whole history of people changing their names, trying to fit in, and he says that this is precisely what leads to anti-Semitism. So if you're going to say that's blaming the victim, I don't know, maybe it is, but that's what he says. And then he goes further. In page 50 to 51, enemies attack us when we loosen our hands from Torah study. So here's another example that if we are connected to Torah study, they wouldn't come after us. The attempt to be equal to the other nations and the departure from our uniqueness are the essential failings and lead us into troubles from our enemies. And then he talks about the failure in Torah study. leads to harsh execution of judgment that is from God. And this is the spirit behind the enmity of the nations. And we saw last week how Joseph discusses in the introduction, but Nisiv is explaining what's unique, right? I don't know if it's unique, but significant in that he doesn't just say that God punishes us when we abandon Torah and mitzvos, but he says that the nations themselves come to hate us even more when we abandon Torah. I don't know if this is empirically true. It might have been true in places like, I don't know, Germany, perhaps. Sometimes, I don't know. I think for the most part, we know that often the anti-Semitism was actually the reverse. So maybe in an eschatological, not as, in a theological sense, you could say that God brings the anti-Semitism because we are no longer observant, but we do have many, many times when it's just the opposite, where you see cases where the non-Jews, and I think this way in America, when they look at Hasidim and others who are so different and are so at odds with the general ethos of society, that leads to anti-Semitism. But maybe not. Maybe it's just my misunderstanding. So I'm sure you can find examples of both of them. The Nitziv even elsewhere states that when the nations expel the Jews, they later regret it, since they see that they brought problems among themselves by their actions. It's right now, I've been, well, not just now, even for the last like 4 months, every day I try to give myself a good 40 minutes or so of reading up on Portugal. Because God willing, this craziness we're in now will all be finished. And the Torah in Motion trip to Portugal will go off as planned in August, please God. But so I'm reading all about Portugal, and what you find is among when they came to terms with what they did to the Jews, much at least about a century earlier than what happened in Spain. And you see leading intellectuals in Portugal and political figures saying that this was a terrible thing by expelling the Jews. We hurt our economy. We hurt our sense of what it means to be a liberal person. We need to invite them back. And already in the early 19th century, they invite the Jews back. And you found also in the 20th century in Spain as well, an acknowledgement, not just what they lost from in a cultural sense, but in an economic sense, because of the great decline of Spain. You know, they attached they connected this to the expulsion of Jews, which is not incorrect. You know, the Jews were a very important aspect of the middle class, of the merchant class, and they really shot themselves in their foot in the foot by doing this. So the Nitziv is not just expressing some hope that they would regret this. They really did, at least many of them really did regret it, so much so that in Portugal the king he saw what happened in Spain. And he said that the Jews are expelled, and then when they all come to Lisbon, rather than expelling them, what he does is he forcibly converts them. When I say forcibly, I mean by literally taking them and baptizing them by force. He took the children were taken away earlier, a whole group of children were taken away, and he forced the Jews to remain in Portugal. That way, he could have his cake and eat it too, as it were. That is, why do you have to get rid of him? Because at least it's recorded that he was marrying the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, and as part of the agreement, he had to expel the Jews. Really, if you look carefully, his agreement was that he had to expel the conversos who had come from Spain. But in any event, and those are the ones whose children he kidnapped, and the idea was to keep them there. But he also didn't want to get rid of the Jews because he knew that would destroy the economy. And therefore, he figured out a way to satisfy the church and everyone else by forcibly converting them. He gave them like 20 years that the Inquisition would not be involved with them. But nevertheless, it didn't help him that much in the end because many Jews ended up fleeing and escaping, etc. Okay, returning to where we are, then it's it. He also wrote, we spoke about his commentary on Halachic Midrash and how unusual that was. I'll just repeat a few things because we have a bunch of new people on today. But what I didn't mention really is he wrote a commentary on Talmud, Maromai Sada, which I don't know how much it's used today. It's along the lines of the old-fashioned commentaries, which are on the daf. And It reminds me, I guess, of like the Aruch HaNer of Yaakov Ettlinger and even Sfas Emes, commentaries on the daf, not like we think of today with long Pilpulim. And we'll see what the Nitziv says about his approach to Pilpul and his understanding of Talmudic commentary. That's not unusual to write commentaries in the Talmud. It's to be expected. But what is unusual, of course, as we've said, is a writing commentary on Halachic Midrash. And Gil Perl in his book discusses this a good deal. Interestingly, at this time, Rav Kook was, as we know, was his great student, his Talmud Muvak, you could even say. And Rav Kook's first published work is a defense of his Rebbe, the Netziv, his Rosh Yeshiva. And this takes us back to the Amek Dover. If we have time, not today, next class, I'm going to bring you some very interesting ideas from the Nitziv's commentary. We'll get to one, I hope, today. What the Nitziv, how he explains the notion of monarchy in the Hamek Davar, something which is perhaps similar to the Abarbanel's view, but it's an anti-monarchical perspective. And we'll get to that. And the rest, hopefully, we'll be able to do next class. But the Nitziv's commentary, the Hamek Davar, is really his greatest lasting work, which you see everywhere. People still study it. I like the new edition that came out a number of years ago by Rabbi Kupperman. Rabbi Kupperman of Michlala is known for his famous commentary on the Meshech Chachma, and that was really his specialty, the Meshech Chachma. He passed away a few years ago. He was the head of Michlala. However, he also wrote a commentary. When I say a commentary, it's not a commentary like you think of, perhaps. He doesn't really talk about, he's not a super commentary as much as notes, explaining what the Nitziv is referring to, bringing down the sources, but it's very, very helpful. Sort of like Chevel does on the Ramban, Rabbi Kupperman does in five volumes on the Nitziv, and Rabbi Kupperman's son put together a nice collection. A topical collection of comments in the Nitziv, in the Nitziv's writings. So the Hamek Davar is really his most famous work and the one that's most used. Well, believe it or not, it was subject to a very, very harsh attack. Unfortunately, I couldn't find the attack because it's in the newspaper Machzikei Hadas from 1890. 18, I'll give you the date here, 1886. You can find certain issues of this online on the Hebrew newspaper site, but not those issues. So I can they're missing. But what we do have is Rav Kook's response. So we see what was said, and Rav Kook's response was published also in the newspaper called Machzikei Hadas. That this is the group Machzikei Hadas that we spoke about, that the Nitziv from Galicia, the Nitziv wrote against them in 1884. Now, the Nitziv's Tshuva, where volume one was only published 1890, I forget, but after 1884. But it must be that the Tshuva of the Nitziv against Machzikei Hadas' advocacy of separatism was spread around before the Meshiv Dover was published. Because I'm assuming that the reason there's such a harsh attack on the Nitziv 2 years after his responsum is that they didn't like this and they were going to get even with the Nitziv. And we see, how do we know then Rav Kook's response? Because it was preserved by the family and others, even though you can't see it online, and it was reprinted. You can all see it here. This is Rav Moshe Tzuriel. There is Otsro Tariya. See how thick it is. There are seven volumes of this, and this includes all of Rav Kook's writings that were not included by all of his essays, all of many of his letters, anything that wasn't included in the works, the white books. The white books, all the books of Rav Kook, they're included in here, and it's a standard text now, a very important work. And if you look in volume two, pages 139 on, you could see Rav Kook's response. Rav Kook is born in 1865, so this is published when Rav Kook is 21 years old, and it's a defense of the Nitziv. It was, I mean, you can just see that the attack, it wasn't a substantive attack, at least, maybe the third issue, which we don't have. the third installment, assuming there was a third installment, it was more substantive. But it's just nitpicking and attacking for no reason. I'll give you an example that he deals a great deal with here. And by the way, he refers to the Nitziv as Admor. I gotta shut this down, the sound. I'm on a different computer, as you can see, so let me shut this down here. This is my WhatsApp. So let me try to close this down here. Yeah. Okay. He calls him Admor Shlita, which is, okay. We'll see. Actually, turn sound off. He calls him Admor, so you see his respect. It turns out that in the Amik Davar, this is in Devarim chapter 10, Pasuk Yudalid 14. he's commenting on the pasuk. What does Hashem ask of you? And he brings the midrash that says, as it were, God says to David, you said, Achashalti, you know, Achashalti Meshem, I only ask one thing from God, but yet you ask a lot. And then David replies, you said, what does God ask for you? And yet, you know, you're asking a lot. What does the pasuk say? It's in Yud Bet, sorry, not Yudal. It says, Vatay Yisrael, Ma Hashem al kechashol meimach. Israel, what does God ask of you? He knows he only asks you to love God and walk in his ways and to serve him with all your heart. And yet you have all these mitzvahs. So it's that's what the Midrash says. And the Nitziv says on this, Shalishon Namzal b'Midrash Zeh, Huloshon Haltzi. He says that that the Midrash, what I just wrote to you, is Loshon Haltzi. So what does that mean? Well, the guy who's attacks the Netziv goes off on him. How could he say this? He's speaking disrespectfully about the sages. And Rav Kook shows that he doesn't know what he's talking about, that this word Haltzi does not come from like Leitzanus, like mocking. He made it seem as if the Netziv is mocking Chazal. And Rav Kook explains, no, it's from the word Melitza. And then he explains even the word Havai. Havai is used, the Lashon Havai, can be seen as a negative expression, but the Chazal also used this expression. So it was someone who obviously had a mission. He was on a mission to destroy the Nitziv. And those who read the Sforim blog know sometimes when people go on missions to destroy someone, they're not thinking properly and correctly. And that's from Rav Kook. Okay, returning to the Nitziv. We've spoken in previous classes about the Nitziv's great love for Eretz Yisrael, the need to work with the irreligious for Eretz Yisrael if necessary, etc. One thing I didn't mention yet deals with the Shemitah year. When you think of people who love Eretz Yisrael, take Rav Kook for instance, they obviously love all of Torah, but since they have special love and connection to Eretz Yisrael, Rav Moliver, you know, Rav Yitzchok Spector, it's understandable why, when it came to the problem of the Shemitah year, that you know, how can the farmers, they have if they don't work the land, they're gonna be driven to bankruptcy, even starvation perhaps, that the Heter Mechira was brought into play. The Heter Mechira, the plan whereby you sell the land during the sabbatical year to a non-Jew, this wasn't invented by the anti-Zionists. This wasn't invented by the people opposed to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Of course, it was invented by the people who were very much committed to and attached to the new Yishuv. And yet, there is one great exception, the Nitziv. The Nitziv, who is the head of Chovei Tzion, who is just as attached to the new settlements as any of these people, he is a strong opponent of the sale of the land. And in fact, he tells us that it's precisely because of his love of the land that he has this stringent view of not relying on any leniencies in selling the land in the sabbatical year. Because now that we're returning to the land of Israel, we have to be very careful. We have to observe Shabbos in all the settlements. We can't make do tricks or anything with the sabbatical year. And only by being entirely committed and following every way, thing that God wants us to do will we be worthy of settling again in the land of Israel. So for the Nitziv, it's his great love and respect for the notion of living in the land of Israel that leads him to oppose the Heter Mechira. Even a temporary sale. This Heter Mechira is like the sale of chametz. It's not permanent. It's temporary. You're selling the land, but you're going to buy it back. Even for that, that is forbidden according to him because it's still a sale. I mean, just like chametz has to be a real sale. We know it's not a real sale because we're going to buy it back from a halachic sense. Though it is a sale, it actually takes effect. I mean, and it is a sale, but believe it or not, there's one of the commentators in Shulchan Aruch though says that you can, you can hide the key so that the non-Jew doesn't get it, and all sorts of things. So, some people call it harama. Others say no, it's not a harama. Harama means sort of like a legal fiction that it's an actual sale. But when it comes to, and so it's the same thing with the sale of the land of Israel because so. Some say it's harama, but it's a valid harama. What I mean, it's harama, because if a non-Jew comes and wants to buy the land, Eretz Yisrael, and fine, to buy the land, he has to come up with, let's say, $1 billion. So let's say the Arabs come up with $1 billion, we still wouldn't sell it to him. Now that's not going to happen, but if it did happen, we still wouldn't sell it to him. So in what sense? Because we're not going to give up the land of Israel. I guess the post-scheme would have to deal with it. We'll find another way not to get out of it. But it is, at least according to most, I think it is a valid sale, not just even more than Harama, but it's a temporary sale. The people who supported the Heter Mechira pointed out, well, if you look at the reason given, the Rambam even gives the reason. I think it's in the Sefer Mitzvos, as to why, it's the Sefer Mitzvos, as to why you can't sell the land to non-Jews. It's because they're going to bring their idolatry into it. Well, if that's the reason, then if you sell it to a Muslim who doesn't worship idols, it should be permissible, because the reason. Yet, some people were going to say that the reason is separate from it, but others say no, that the reason that there's a reason why you can't sell it. Just a Ger Toshav can live there. So, too, we can assume that, in for certain respects, that a Muslim has the status of a Ger Toshav. And that was the famous reason given why they thought you could sell the land to an Arab. But no, the Nitziv doesn't buy this. He says Arabs are not Ger Toshav, because to be a Ger Toshav, you need a formal acceptance of the Noahide laws. That doesn't exist. You can't do that. You don't have that today. We don't have, based on the God, all the things you need. And he explains his whole view. In the Meshiv Dover, there's a section in here called Kuntres Devar HaShmita, which you'll find in Volume 1. And that's where he explains his position. The only thing I want to add to this is that the Nitziv is often quoted as saying as follows, and you can find this on Volume 2, page 58a. You'll find this. All the Hebrew sources, Rabbi Bleich, in his article on the sabbatical year, cites it, that it says as follows. It says that though he's citing the person who argued that you can be lenient, the way I explained it, he says that this Rav Barach Mehazev Ufaga Bo Ari, that is, he ran from the wolf, and he hit a lion. Why? They're trying to, solve the problem of Shemitah year, which according to most is rabbinical. So in order to not to deal with the sabbatical year, which is rabbinical, they're going to sell the land, and he uses the phrase Ovdei Galilim because the from a halachic standpoint, the Muslims, even though they don't worship it, they still have the status because if they're not Ger Toshav, they're in that category for the Nitziv. There's only two categories: the Ger Toshav that you can sell the land to, and the idolater, who includes everyone, which you cannot sell the land to, everyone who's not a Ger Toshav. And this is cited by everyone, that the people they jump from the wolf to something even worse, the lion. It would be better, he's saying, just to work the land. That's rabbinic. Here you're selling it and it's a Torah violation. Well, if you have the new edition, which I have, right at the beginning of that section, what it does is the Netziv has a tshuva, and you see his name is over there. It ends, and then it begins with a new section. Everyone assumed that that was just sort of like an appendix, a PS. It's not. They explain it here, that this section, which has that famous expression everyone cites in the name of the Netziv, was not written by the Netziv. It's written by another rabbi, Yeshua Heschel Margolios. It was in the papers of the Netziv, and when they organized the papers, and this is from Rav Chaim Berlin himself, when they organized the papers, they mistakenly included it. So he says that the Achrayas, Ein Achrayas Kol Mamar Zeh Aleinu, as we have no connection to this piece. It's although for many, many years, some people knew about this because the Rav Chaim Berlin made his opinion public. But who knew about this really? Just some people did. It was published in some Torah journal. Everyone bought the Meshiv Dover. They saw this, and they assume this is the Netziv as well. Rav Kook, he actually takes issue with his Rebbe, Admor, as he calls him. I don't know if he calls him that in the tshuva and Mishpat Kohen. That's what, as I said, he called him before. He takes issue with this. And Rav Kook says, he mentions him by name, that according to the Ravid, the Arabs have the status of Ger Toshav. Yes, they don't have a complete status of Ger Toshav because there's no way to do it in today's day and age. But the fact that they don't worship idolatry or anything like that, they have the status of Ger Toshav when it comes to selling land and other things as well. They can dwell in the land. They're allowed to dwell in the land. And since they could dwell in the land, you can sell them land, and certainly you can sell them land temporarily. Let me now call your attention to something else in the Hamakdavar. Let me get my Hamakdavar here. His Perush Hamakdavar to Devarim, chapter 17, verse 14, you find something really interesting. It's Parsha Shoftim. It says, Ba, when you come to the land and dwell there, and you say, the Amarta, you will say, Asima alai melech kol goyim asher svivasai. I want to have a king. You know, the Jews come into the land of Israel, Bnei Israel, they want to have a king like all the nations. So what is the approach to monarchy? And the standard view that you'll find is that it's a mitzvah. That Bnei Israel, there was a mitzvah, they were obligated, this is the mitzvah to establish a king. At least that's how it's quoted in the Gemara, it's quoted in the Rambam, as I recall. The commentaries have to reconcile that with the story in the book of Shmuel, what's going on there, and why is Shmuel so upset with them? And the standard answer given is similar to the language I just read to you, Kahol Goyim. That is, that the reason they wanted the king was to be like the nations. But to have the king, just to have a king for the right reasons, that's a good thing. It doesn't explain really why it took so long to have a king. They wanted to have a king as soon as they entered Eretz Israel. Okay, so you could say the tribes were not connected yet, so they couldn't. But in any event, normally this is understood as a mitzvah, but not just a mitzvah, an obligation, because you can have a mitzvah that's not an obligation in certain areas. At least Rav Moshe Feinstein holds, I'll just mention because we did a Yeshiva Eretz Yisrael, Rav Moshe Feinstein holds that living in the land of Israel is a mitzvah, but it's not an obligation. That is, you fulfill a mitzvah if you do what he calls it, a mitzvah kiyumis, but you're not obligated. The Netziv says something very similar when it comes to malchus, and it's pretty unique. The Abarbanel perhaps precedes him in certain ways, but I still think he's unique. Well, first of all, it says, when you come to the land of Israel, the Amarta, and you will say that I'm going to put a king upon us. He says that Amira doesn't mean, what does it mean? It doesn't mean spoken. It can mean, it means other things at all. Like if you say, you want, Vamarta, I want to eat meat, as you intend. Then he says that this language, you'll come in and you'll say, "I want a king." What does it say that? Just simply say, if Hashem wanted you to have a king, he would say, just would say he'd skip verse 14 and begin verse 15. Som tasim alach hamelech. You should establish for yourself a king. So the Netziv says, what this lashon is mashma she'ein zo mitzvah b'muchat limnos melech el rishus. He says there is no obligation to appoint a king, but it's rishus. Just like in the when it says, if you say I will eat meat, you don't have to eat meat. But then he says yadua b'divrei chazal de mitzvah limnos melech. But he says we do see chazal say it's a mitzvah. So he explains as follows. This is an unbelievable chiddush. He says that different forms of government can change. He says, not at all times and at all places are people going to be interested, are people going to want a king. He says it could be either alpidas melucha or alpidas avnivchareim, either monarchy or democracy. And he says, there will be places, yesh medina she'en yechol lisbol das melucha. There will be certain societies, I think in Western societies today would be an example, which can't suffer with a king, don't want a king. V'yesh medina she'bolo melech harehi kasfina bolo kabernit. And there are other societies that without a king, they're like a ship without a captain. Those of you who are listening, who are with me in Morocco, they love their king. You tell them, well, what do you want a king for? You should have democracy. No, they want a king. They like a king. I was, 2 months ago, I went to Jordan, and my son had the bright idea to ask our Bedouin guide, we're down by Eilat, what he thinks about King Hussein. So I don't know if in a dictatorship he has a question like that. So he explained how you people in the West, you like democracy, but we're a traditional society and we like having a king. And I don't think he just was saying that because he explained all the reasons why having a king is good. So then Itziv says certain societies, yes, monarchy, others, no. And he says, therefore, since it doesn't work in some societies, to have a king, because they're going to want a democracy. You can't make it an obligatory commandment. And this is fascinating. He says, because matters that have to do with, ruling the community, he says it has to do with sakanas nefashos, pikuach nefesh. What does that mean? I think what he's saying that, I don't think he's talking about war. I think what he's saying is everything that goes on in a society could affect matters of life and death. And, if you don't, you're going to have a king, maybe he doesn't know how to run the country properly. And that could lead to situations that can make the land weak. Invaders could come in. Maybe he doesn't know how to encourage growth of certain crops, and you're going to be led to famine. I'm not exactly sure what it means. I think I saw someone who said that because the king could lead you into war, and that could be pikuach nefesh. But I don't think so. I'm not sure if that's what he means. Maybe I have it here where I saw that person who said that. I can't find where I thought. I think maybe you think that is the answer. I don't know. I just think that it's general. If you don't have a ruler who works for the people, it could lead to sakanas nefashos. Hey, the people could revolt. Who knows what it could lead to? So he says it can't be a mitzvah asay for all times and all places. What he says, however, is that for those people for whom this is the sort of government that they appreciate and they want, for them it's a mitzvah. And he goes further, by the way. He says because of the sakaras of fashos mishum hachi eif shalat savos behechlet limnos melch. You can't command them to appoint a king. Kol zman shlo ala b'haskamatam lispo ol melch. If the people don't want it, you can't have it. Why won't they want it? Al pi sheroim medinos asher sviraseim misnagim b'seiro yotzer nachon. He says they're going to look around and they're going to see nations around them who don't have a king, and it works better for them. So you're going to tell, is he anticipating the messianic era here? Because what is he speaking about here? There weren't any democracies in the days of ancient Israel. He's saying, though, that you cannot command Israel to have a king if the people don't want a king. The mitzvah to appoint a king, and then it becomes a mitzvah, is when they want it. And if they want it, then you appoint a king, and all the laws about a king, how many wives he could take, how he can go to war, etc., etc. But there's no obligation to have a king if the people don't want it. So it's a mitzvah saseh, but not an obligatory mitzvah saseh at all times. And he says that's why for 300 years, the Mishkan was in Shiloh, and those 300 years the Mishkan was in Shiloh, they didn't have a king because the people didn't want a king. They weren't in agreement about a king. So we see this is an amazing passage. I don't know what's the most amazing about it. Perhaps that he's saying that the people are going to look at the other forms of government and say that those forms of government are better than our, better than having a king. When do mitzvahs depend upon you look at other forms of government? But here it does, according to the Tziv, because it never was an absolute. It was left to the people. What does this say about Melech HaMashiach? The Tziv doesn't seem to make any distinction here. You can have Mashiach, but Mashiach does not Melech HaMashiach. Mashiach could be a spiritual leader, but that doesn't mean that all of a sudden we're going to revert to a monarchy, like the Rambam says, that the Abarbanel doesn't seem to say this. The Abarbanel, who also doesn't like monarchy, he doesn't like monarchy, and he lived through monarchies in Portugal and Spain. He sees the problem, but and he believes that the ultimate monarch is, of course, God. But if you're going to have a messianic figure who's going to be completely righteous, Abarbanel doesn't have a problem. Maybe the Nitziv's attitude is that if the messianic king, since he'll be so obviously righteous and he's not going to be only looking out for himself, etc., then the people will immediately recognize that this is the proper approach and they'll want that, meaning it's a mitzvah, but that's not normally how we think about it. It seems to me at least, because I don't see how you can distinguish between the Torah's command and the messianic era, it's the same command. He seems to be saying that even in the messianic era, the form of government is dependent on the Jewish people. Do they want to live with a king or not? And having lived under democracy for so long, most Jews, I think, have accepted the notion, I think it was Churchill who said it, that democracy is a, what do they say, a bad system, but all the others are even worse, something like that. Very original by the Nitziv, something that could only have been said beginning in the 19th century, when you're seeing, democracies, young democracies in America, England, France, and you contrast what you're seeing in those places. Well, they're not obviously like today, complete democracies. Women didn't have the right to vote, et cetera, et cetera. If you didn't have property, you couldn't vote in many places, but at least comparing what's going on in Western Europe and in America, which the Nitziv knew all about. He read the newspaper each week. He read it even on Shabbos, which is the real reason why I believe the biography of my uncle, the Nitziv, was censored. Perhaps that's one of I think that's the real reason. It showed him reading newspapers on Shabbos and other things, not what we're going to speak about in a minute, although probably they're both combined, both added. But when you're comparing how Jews are living in England and in Germany and in America with how Jews were living under an absolute monarch, the Tsar, it's not hard to see how you could conclude that having a monarchy is not always the best thing. But he doesn't say, our monarchy is going to be a better monarchy, not like the monarchy we see around. He assumes that the whole notion of a monarchy is left to the Jewish people. So unbelievable chiddush of the Nitziv. Okay, let me go on. We have, I'm going to go actually till 10. And then we'll take the questions because I do have a lot still I want to do. May we'll see about if we can finish next week. Maybe we can go on one more week. But I do want to go to 10 o'clock. I think people are feeling a little bit, many of us are in quarantine almost. I'm not officially in quarantine, but in my town, we're supposed to stay at home, and my kids are not allowed to have play dates. So we're spending a lot of time at home. So we don't have anywhere to go. I want to. To mention to you now another responsum he has in the Meshuv Dover. It's in volume 3, number 14. He's asked a very interesting question from someone in Tiberias. A man sold half of his share of his merits, his the reward from the mitzvahs he did, to someone else. And the deal was that this guy was also going to buy the other half. No, sorry, the buyer. Someone bought them. And from someone his merits, and then he was going to buy the other half. He bought half of it, but the buyer later had second thoughts. He didn't want to complete the deal. He only bought half the schar of the mitzvah, but not all the schar. It says that in the tshuva, it says that the buyer discussed with some rabbi who inquired of heaven in a dream, some makubal he spoke to. And this Makubal learned in a dream that the person who sold him his merits, his schar, didn't actually have these merits. So it's like if I sell someone all my merits in Olam Haba, I sell him half of them, and I'm going to sell them when he gets a little more money, I'm going to sell them the rest of them. But then the guy finds out that I don't really have any merits, so he's not really buying anything. He wants to avoid the sale. And not only does he want to avoid the sale, he wants to get his money back. I have to give him the money back because he's telling me that this guy saw in the dream that I don't have any merits. So now I have to give him his money back. But I'm saying, and this is what the Shuva describes, that a sale is a sale. And not only am I not giving you back your money, but you have to buy the other half of my merits. Is this a valid sale? A very strange question. First, the Netziv says that the person who sold his merits for money showed that he's not a tzaddik. And he's no different, he says, than Esav who sold his birthright. What sort of person sells his spiritual reward for money? Most important thing is spiritual reward. So the fact that you're going to sell your spiritual reward for a reward in this world, namely monetary reward, shows you that you're not a tzaddik. So I guess you don't need to have a dream from heaven to tell you that. That was obvious. But then the Tziv says, well, what about the idea of selling? Can a sale, fine. The guy's not tzaddik and he shouldn't have bought it, but is the sale valid? And he says, no. You cannot sell the reward of the mitzvahs you perform. First of all, and it's like a Choshen Mishpat question, you can't sell something that's not in your possession. I don't own the reward. The reward is waiting for me, if I have a reward, in heaven. If God has the reward and he's going to give it to me, I can't sell it. It's not mine, like it's in my pocket or anything like that. So you can't sell it. Also, the Netziv says, quite apart from the Choshen Mishpat idea that you can't sell it if you don't have it, you can't sell something spiritual. The rewards are not a gift that God gives you, and then you can transfer them. He says they follow from doing the action. They're attached to the action. They're not a piece of goodies that you put in a jar that you can then give out. The Catholics had this idea, the sale of indulgences. Sometimes people, when they read about the sale of indulgences, which is seen as the ultimate example of corruption in the Catholic Church before the Reformation, that you pay off the priest or pay off the church, give him a donation, all of a sudden your sins are forgiven. It was a little more complicated than that. The notion was they had this notion of called the transfer of merit, that is that the church, because of its exalted state, had access to merit, grace that God had given it. And it was able to distribute some of this merit to whoever was deserving of it. So it's not like just a quid, like I just give them money and now they say I'm forgiven. It's a little more complicated, this whole theological doctrine of a transfer of merit, which It sounds like something you might see in certain Hasidic thinkers, but I don't know if we have anything like that, where maybe one of the Hasidim who listen can tell me where a Rebbe can either transfer some of his merit, or just he has control of merit that's sort of like out there, like in some Platonic sense, that the Hasidic Rebbe can transfer this merit to individuals. I'm not aware of any example of this. I wouldn't be surprised if he did have stories of Hasidic Rebbes that said they could transfer merit to individuals. We know Hasidic Rebbes have all the sitkos and they could use it. They could use it to start wars, to stop wars, to bring rain, to heal people. But that's different than taking the merit they have and actually transferring it to someone else so that a sinner now has his sins forgiven because the merit has been transferred, as opposed to the Rebbe davening so that the sinner will be forgiven. So if anyone knows of any sources, you can let me know. Okay, and as for, then the Nitziv goes on and says, what about selling the reward for the study of Torah? Because that was also included in the sale. All the Torah he learned, and he probably didn't learn so much Torah, but all the Torah he learned, the merit of this Torah was also included in the sale. And this already have we do have a concept of Yisachar and Zvulun that Zvulun will get some of the schar of Yisachar, but not, it's not really a sale. It's sort of like a partnership. But the Nitziv, I again, when you listen to the Nitziv's answer, you have to ask yourself, well, what about Yisachar Zvulun? He says that the reward, he says this makes no sense that you could transfer the reward for studying Torah to someone else. He says the reward for studying Torah is to the is to enter the Yeshiva Shalmala. You're going to go up there where your Torah will hold you in good stead because that's the Yeshiva Shalmala. You'll be a Torah study on an advanced level, however the Nitziv understood it. But if you never actually studied, then what's the point of the reward? What good is being in the Yeshiva Shalmala? He says it's like being given, if someone who has an ailment gives you medicines, but you don't have that ailment, what good is it? It doesn't do anything for you. The obvious question to know is what about then what's the whole business of Yisachar and Zvulun? Unless you say that that it's not really, you're not getting, Zvulun is not getting the reward for studying Torah, they're getting the reward for enabling them to study the Torah. And then I guess that's how you could explain it. It just occurred to me. We have to say Zvulun's getting a reward for enabling them for studying the Torah. Although usually we say differently, we say it's the reward of studying the Torah, but that's for the Nitziv, I think you'd have to say it that way. Oh, I see it's already 9:58. We didn't even get to what where we're going to start next time. I'm going to get to the questions now. I'll go over them. We're going to pick up immediately when we begin next class. Why was the Volozhin Yeshiva closed? We spoke so much about the Volozhin Yeshiva. So why was it closed? What was the Nitziv's role in that? And then all sorts of other things we have to get to. So let me look at some of the questions and comments. Let's see here. Thank you, Baruch. Rav Chaim, Baruch says Rav Chaim was atypical in his quick davening. I don't know. I hear so many stories how in the Litvisha world, the stress was not on the davening, it was on the learning. And we know that they in the yeshiva world, they kept, they were. I don't want to say sensitive, but they were suspicious of people who were too much davening, and people who looked like they were having too much kavana and too much shuckling. That was the sort of thing that they, yes, you have to daven, there's a time to daven, but people who were, that got too involved in this, I mean, I've seen this in numerous times that that's, it breaks from the mold. Now, you had examples, Navardic and others. We have the world's expert of Navardic listening here, but, in general, that's not that wasn't what they put the focus on. Rabbi Yechiel of Weinberg talks about how he would miss mincha sometimes. And he's not the only one. They were so involved in their learning. Okay, so Baruch says Litvish davening is slow and serious. If today it is fine, and you're saying Hasidic davening is often very speedy, but I can tell you what Eisenstadt says in his memoir, and I just know, having grown up by teachers, and that's what we were always told. But Baruch says that I have it reversed, and that it's the Chassidish davening. I mean, Chassidus, the whole idea of Chassidus is the focus on davening and everything in the Litvish world. I remember Chaim Soloveitchik once saying that he gave a whole thing about how in the Litvish world, Tefillah B'Tzibur, how it wasn't that important. So we'll have to, if you send it to me, I'll send you some sources. Jay Kelman says, Shaul Stamfer notes the same thing, and the Rav has a beautiful piece on how davening and learning are opposite mitzvot. We know that in the Mashgichim, in the Litvish yeshivas, would speak about how you have to daven, how it's important, and you have to put kavan on everything. That shows you that many people were not focused on it, that they just wanted to finish it to get back to their learning. If the Mashgichim have to over and over again speak about the importance of davening, and don't just do it by rote, and don't just see it as something you have to get through, it shows that they weren't taking it that way. We know the Hasidim thought that that was a big defect among the Misnagdim, that they didn't approach davening the way they should. Heschel said that the problem of the Orthodox, and it means the Misnagdim, is that they're not in awe of God. They're in awe of the Shulchan Aruch. They don't have this connection anymore to God, tefillah and everything. It's all about legalisms. And in the yeshiva world, you could say it's all about intellectualism. Moshe says that Rosh Hashanah's grandson writes in his biography that his grandfather davened very quickly, often finishing before everyone. Rav Isaac Harif often davened quickly. Okay, thank you, Moshe. I'll give you an example of one who is not a chassid, but he's not Litvish. I'm talking about the Litvish yeshiva world. Rav Meshulam Igra, who was the Rav of Pressburg, Bratislava today, he would daven. Not only would he daven slow, but he would make all these movements, jump around, and everything. And they say that he would do that because every minute, every second, a Tosfos and an explanation of a Rashba, they were all popping in his head. And the only way to keep his head clear of the learning so they could focus on davening was to jump around. So his biography, it tells that one of the Balabatim, who of course was an Amoritz, as the typical Balabas was in those days, starts doing the same thing, starts running back and forth, jumping around. And Meshulam Igra says to him, he says, I do this because the Tosfos is jumping in my head. The Rambam is saying, nothing's going in your head, so why are you jumping up around like this? Didn't Shaul Lieberman learn Slabodka? Most of yeshivas certainly strict on davening. Of course, Shaul Lieberman learned it, Slabodka, which was the Musar Yeshiva. But the Musar Yeshivas were always fighting this battle of trying to, yes, of trying to get people to follow it. Yes, it was a Musar Yeshiva, but it doesn't seem also that Shaul Lieberman carried much Musar with him. Rabbi Chaya Weinberg went to the Slabodka, and he is the first one to tell you that he's not a Musarnik, that he didn't take, he, I mean, he appreciated Musar, but he wasn't Musarnik. I can't speak for them. I can just tell you what's recorded. No, Lieberman davened, but hell, Halkin said, Moshe, that he didn't want to daven. He's sitting and learning, and it comes time to davening. He says to Halkin, almost like, why do I have to get up and go daven now? God knows what I want, and it's Bittul Torah. If he could, he would have remained learning, but he had to daven because of the halacha. Is that how we're supposed to daven? Are we supposed to daven because it's a chiyuv, and we have to daven? That's not how our approach is supposed to be to davening. But that's how Lieberman expressed it, that he felt like he did it because he feels like it's halacha. He has to, but he'd rather be learning. And yet, as I said, I think it was Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you'd even see a tear in his eye. Maybe he felt a bit like, they say mitzvos. Not all mitzvos, not all halachas, we have to be happy about. It's like they say the Chazon Ish said that you have to vote in the elections in Israel. And so they asked him, well, is this, what they say, is this a halacha? I forget what they said. Is it halacha like eating matzah? That you have to do it? A mitzvah, he says, a mitzvah. A mitzvah eating matzah? He says, no, it's a mitzvah like maror. Sometimes you have to do something. We have to vote in the election, even though we wish we didn't have to vote because we don't want to be involved in this with this secular government. All I'm saying is that for people like Lieberman, and I'm sure many others, the people who I mentioned who forgot Mincha, maybe they felt that if they could continue learning, it would be better. But what are you going to do? We have to daven. I don't know. Remember when I was in yeshiva, they spoke to us about this, that that's something that's lacking among us, that we're good on learning, but when it comes to davening, we have to work on davening also. I remember them telling us that. Yehuda says about davening with a minyan. Reb Berkowitz records that his Rebbe Weinberg didn't daven with a minyan for mincha. That's what I was thinking of, but it's more than that, because in his essay Yehuda about Rav Yitzhak Blazer, or Natalie Amsterdam, I forget which one. He talks about how he went to, he's speaking to, he went to Natalie Amsterdam, and he says he sometimes forgets to daven mincha. And Natalie Amsterdam, or Yitzhak Blazer, says to him, "You forget entirely?" And he says, "Well, no, I forget to daven with a minyan." But really, he forgot to daven totally because he's so busy learning. And he told this to the Netziv and then to the altar of Sobotka, and the altar was upset with him. That how did you not tell the truth? He made him go back to tell the truth that he forgets totally, and but right before he gets to the house, then the altar sends someone to stop him, and he just wanted him to know what it's like to confess his untruth, but he didn't have to actually go through it. Okay, Moshe says the Midrash blames anti-Semitism precisely for making us different. Yeah. There were plenty of people who spoke about the anti-Semitism in Germany as a result that we tried to be like the Goyim. Moshe from Lakewood says regarding davening with a minyan, didn't Montefiore always bring a minyan with him when he traveled? Indeed, he did. He had Loewy who came with him, Louis Loewy, Eliezer Loewy, but he had a minyan that he brought with him. I don't know if he always did. When he traveled, I know when he went to Ramsgate and went places like that, he brought a minyan. I don't think when he went to Morocco, or he had this famous trip to Morocco, that he brought a minyan. I've never seen any record of that, but we know that he would travel to Ramsgate, which is where he was. There he would bring a minyan there with him. The whole idea of minyans of interest because we have sources that speak of it as basically a chiyuv. But other sources do not say it's a chiyuv at all. It's on the tzibur. It's not on the individual. I remember when I think it was Judith Hauptman wrote this essay about women and minyan, arguing that you could count w women in a minyan, and it has to deal with the whole thing that well, wait a second, if women are not obligated in a minyan and men are obligated, it's a problem. So how do you, they're not at the same level of obligation. And I remember thinking that, well, there's plenty of sources she could have cited had she known them. Yisrael Moshe Chazan is one, Krach Shel Romi, who had questions about, who say there's no such concept of a chiyuv in a minyan. The minyan, it's all reshus, and that's what makes it so great, that you're not obligated, then you have to take it upon yourself. But it's not actually an obligation, meaning that if you don't go, you don't sin. Others do say it's an obligation. Moshe says Menashe ben Israel pointed exactly to economics, besides for messianism, to Cromwell and his petition for English settlement. Okay. Moshe doesn't think Haramah means legal fiction. It means, well, it's not okay. It's usually translated as legal fiction. I think even Kapil Kahana, if I'm not mistaken, in his book on Jewish law, mentions calls it legal fiction. You think it means cheating in quotations, going against the spirit of the law. It is going against the spirit of the law, but is it a, does it fall? I mean, the lawyers can comment better on it's a whether it's a legal fiction, because a legal fiction accomplishes something. It sort of, you could say, goes against the spirit, the legal fiction, I think. I don't know. You're saying legal fiction is something I've written in Shtar Mechira of the Chasam Sofer about selling the Bleios of Chametz, which I never understood. I don't know if that's a legal fiction either. I look up later online legal fiction. I do think people who know, like Kapil Kahana, do use the term. That doesn't mean it's identical. Didn't the Netziv also advocate the use of Esrog Eretz Yisrael That will come next class. Yes, it did influence his Esrog at Corfu. When I brought my group to Corfu, I spoke about that. Next class, God willing, I will speak about his view on the Esrog at Corfu. It didn't just impact, it was like the major reason. Yeah, Moshe says there's two opinions of Gemara if it's a mitzvah to have a king. The problem is the Rambam concludes that it is a mitzvah to have a king. How would he reconcile with this belief in Mashiach? Sounds dangerously close to the Comfort Affair. What Moshe is referring to is a case in Vienna where, well, the argument being Isaiah 53. Does that refer to Mashiach or not? And there was a you had a newspaper article there who said it was not, and he was did not just didn't refer to the Messianic era, and he was brought up on charges of blasphemy against revealed religion, Judaism, Christianity, and he was also condemned by people like Israel Hildesheimer and others. But the Rav of Vienna, Elazar Horovitz, the what's his tshuvas again called? Elazar Horovitz, the name of his tshuvas are escaping me. Someone's going to write it in. He's the one that famously records the Chasam Sofer about not. The Chasam Sofer wrote the tshuva to him that when you don't need mitzitzah of a peh when there's an epidemic like now. I can't imagine anyone today would do mitzitzah of a peh, but we live in such a crazy world that maybe people are doing it. Yeah, the Yad HaLazar. I don't know. Moshe and everyone else, I invite you to look at the Netziv. If he's saying this is the mitzvah and he's not saying it's a machlokes in the past, we've decided like the Rambam, he says it depends on what the people want and if they, are attached to democracy, well, then it's not a mitzvah. If they like monarchy, then it is a mitzvah. He doesn't distinguish. He doesn't add in, well, in Messianic days, it'll be this. And you say, so Rav Waldenberg, we'll have to see that. And Chaim Hirschenson, yes, Rav Chaim Hirschenson, Chaim also discusses monarchy and democracy. And yeah, he's not the only one to say that democracy is superior, but usually, I have to see what Chaim Hirschenson says. Usually they ended off with, but of course, we're talking pre-Messianic era. But in the Messianic era, we will have a perfect monarchy, which will be, won't have any of the defects that Abarbanel and others spoke about. And yes, of course, most of the kings of Israel and Judah were not very good, as Abarbanel points out. But again, it's to find people who actually will say that in the future era, where you're going to have a person who's going to be, but not be, have any of these defects that we saw. Oh, thank you, Mel. Democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. Thank you, Churchill. So Asher says, Menashe Zvulun, meaning Sachar and Zvulun. Yes. Moshe says, what about selling Averos? The Machon Chaim and the Maharsham deal with this inyan too. There's Rav Scheinberg, actually, in that book, All for the Boss. I think it's in there. He speaks about giving someone the merit of his mitzvot so he can do it without getting it, without just do it for the sake of, I think it's in that book, do it for the sake of the mitzvah. Without any reward. And also the said about the Vilna Gaon, something like that. So it's almost as the Gemara and Shabbos chastises those who spend time davening at the expense of learning. Obviously, it has to be a middle ground. You can't, anyone in the Litvisha, anyone in the Litvisha Yeshiva, but challenge me, Baruch, if you think I'm wrong. But from my experience, if you had anyone who spent 15 minutes doing a Shmoneh Esrei in a Litvish yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva would take him over and say, you're taking too long on the Shmoneh Esrei. Because first of all, he'd be taking longer than Rosh Yeshiva, and that doesn't work. There, but of course, if you do it in 2 minutes, that's not good either. So there has to be a middle ground. Baruch, they have Hasidim with the minion factories. I'm not talking, we're talking about idealized here. We're not talking about the Hasid who has to get back to his job. We're talking about, the ideals here. And Rabbi Kelman, we're very happy to have him here because he's been doing Daf Yomi at other times, hasn't been able to join us. He's with us. He's responsible for all this. Usually, the very first class, we welcome him, and he has a link there about the Rav's beautiful piece. Baruch, I don't say that Litvaks believe that davening is factory produced. I simply said that in the Litvish yeshiva world, at least according to many sources, the idea was that davening was not something they put the stress on. And I just read to you Eisenstadt, where he says explicitly that when he got to the yeshiva, that was what surprised him so much, that davening was something you had to get through in order to get back to the most important thing, namely Limud Torah, which, as we know, was Yoser Mikulam, is the highest of everything. Okay, so Shmuel says you have also of Aaron Abel's daven quickly. If Yehuda asks Chaim Malkus, the source for Chaim Hirschman, if you look at Chaim Hirschman, we did four classes, I think, on Chaim Hirschman. If you look in the Malki Bakodesh, in one of the volumes there, he discusses all this. Baruch, I've been to the Hasidic places. I've even been to Stolen. I had yechidus with the Stolen Rebbe. So believe me, I know about Hasidim who daven fast, who daven slow, Stolen being one of them. But I'm talking about, in an ideal sense, what they put the value on, not what happens if you go into a Beis Medrash today and see this or that. And yes, you go into, when I'm in a Litvish Beis Medrash today, they daven slowly. I see this all the time. I daven in Litvish Beis Medrashes. I don't really daven in Hasidic places. But I'm talking about, and I can't even tell you today what happens if you go into Ponovesh. I have no idea. I'm talking about what's expressed by these sources in the great yeshiva, Lithuanian yeshiva world. Maybe I should be like Rakefet. He says the yeshiva world doesn't exist anymore. Once they stop speaking Yiddish, it doesn't exist, et cetera, et cetera. But all I'm saying is that's, I don't know what the yeshiva world is today. In the old time yeshiva world, you won't go for brachos and you won't get shirayim from gedolim and things like that. I can only tell you what is recorded in the memoir literature. What can I tell you? A couple more things and then we'll end. Yeah, so Baruch points out, he mentioned it, someone mentioned already, that in Bells they want to daven fast because they don't want the bad machshavos to come into their head. Talking about Bells, I just saw something very interesting just the other day, and I confirmed it with a Belzer. They do not say hamapil. They for some reason, maybe it's related to that. Yes, I'm sure, Baruch, and we'll end with this. That Rav Kook in Volozhin daven long. If you would have seen Rav Kook's davening, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach mentioned that he once watched Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's davening through the window, and it affected him like an entire year. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer said that if we davened Rosh Hashanah like Rav Kook davens Mincha on a weekday, we, then maybe we'd be getting somewhere. So of course, you had people from the Litvish world, but Rav Kook is not the typical Litvak. Very good, everyone. Good night, and see you next week.